I'm still trying to contact you as well.
Okay.
Okay. Welcome, Ms. Gilwald. How are you? Can you unmute yourself?
Apologies. I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I'm okay, thank you very much. We will start by introducing ourselves. My name is Bulilani Gratitude Magwanishe. I am the chair of the Portfolio Committee of Justice and Correctional Services. I'll be chairing this session today as this panel. Can I ask other members to introduce themselves?
Good afternoon. My name is Glynis Bredenbach. I'm a member of the panel.
Good afternoon. My name is Noma Temba Maseko-Jele. I'm the member of this committee.
Good afternoon. My name is Jacqueline Mufukeng. I'm a member of the committee. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Werner Hoorn, also a member of the committee.
Afternoon. I am Tola Nola, a member of the committee.
Gile Janchi, committee member.
I'm Wilmani Adruchen, but I'm using sign language, so you'll hear the voice of my sign language interpreter, Trudy, at the moment. Honorable Chairperson, I would just like to disclose, I don't know Alison Jewell personally, but I know her as part of the communication sector that I used to be involved with.
Can you repeat that, Honorable Velma? You said you do not know her personally.
I don't know Ms. Alison Jewels personally, but I do know her from the Portfolio Committee of Communications. And I also know that her work in the communication sector, but I don't know her personally, so just to disclose that.
Thank you very much. Honorable Noma Temba Jele, can you introduce yourself?
I have, Chair. You still don't hear me. Hello, Chair? Hello?
You are frozen. Hello? We can hear you.
Okay. My name is Noma Temba Maseko Jele. I'm a member of this committee. Thank you.
But that, for your your video. I think your bandwidth is very low. Thank you very much, Ms. Gilwald, and thank you for availing yourself to serve as a part-time commissioner. We will ask you some few questions as members of the portfolio committee to check your suitability. If later, how would you convince this committee that you would be able to step up into this role? And in doing so, please tell us about who you are, your values and experience.
Thank you very much. I believe I could contribute to this committee by providing a multidisciplinary perspective that I believe is much required as we move into the digital and data era, in fact. I think a lot of the challenges that we are facing around ensuring rights really relate to online rights now. You know, realizing a lot of the other rights require access to internet and digital services, whether it's economic or policy or political rights. So I think in that respect, the experience that I bring from two or three decades of regulation and governance would contribute to the development of the information regulator, but also because it's the kind of evolution of the various forms of governance that I've been involved in as well. Obviously, the information regulator deals with non-digital matters as well, but I think, we're no longer just talking about, digital economy or digital society being a portion of the economy and society. It's actually the whole economy and society. And I think there's increasing evidence that we, have to deal with these challenges that we face that have been described by De Chapelle, an international person who works in internet and jurisdiction, as, one of the greatest challenges that we face globally, this governing of diversity digital governance in order to incorporate people into the digital economy and protect their rights and digital society more broadly. So I think, it will really require that we have a transversal digital policy that various regulatory and governance bodies can really feed into and coordinate activities, across the public sector, but also, between the public and private sector, particularly as we continue increasingly facing the delivery of public goods by private entities. This is a particular challenge for us that we need effective regulation to complement, infrastructure regulation, which is really critical to, achieving the kind of enabling environment for the expression of these other rights, a competition environment to ensure that services are affordable, people can get into them. And then, of course, what's very important in this environment is that we're dealing with, global companies, global monopolies, in fact, with very little accountability to anybody, even the countries that they operate in, and addressing the challenges, the inequalities, the infringement of rights is really going to require high levels of global cooperation in order to be effective. And that's everything from, content governance through to ensuring, equitable tax regimes. So I think, the intersectional nature of my experience and expertise would contribute to what has been a strongly and correctly, obviously, legal perspective on these two areas of data protection and freedom of expression, but which in particularly in the digital environment, in order to ensure that these are substantively realized, requires a strong enabling economic and structural enabling environment for the safeguarding of these rights. And I think my participation in these global forums over two decades, but increasingly in the area of internet and digital governance over the last decade, lend itself to building on these international cooperative instruments. They're more informal than that at the moment, I think, in certain areas, which I know the information regulator has already been very positive in developing with international, very new international regulators across the globe, and particularly those emerging on the African continent. So I think those broadly would be the contribution that I would bring. My values are very in line with the democratic and constitutional values that these bodies are there to enforce. I think particularly as we move into the more advanced technology areas, I reluctantly refer to the fourth industrial revolution because I think that framing of it is a very particular framing that really compels policy really often to leap into that area without addressing the sort of underpinnings that will make that a more equitable era that we can bring everybody along. So I think as we move into that era, it's going to be really important that we have addressed previous backlogs and that we really focus our attention on the awareness building and the education to make sure that everybody is able to exercise these rights. And these institutions that are established are not really only servicing what is in fact a relatively small elite, both globally and in the country, of people who, as COVID has shown, are able to digitally substitute their various, whether it's food or schooling or working online, etc. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a really important contribution.
Thank you very much. Honorable Mola.
Thank you very much, Chair. Ma'am, in accordance to law, we are supposed to appoint a fit and a proper person to be in the regulator. Can you, in less than a minute, explain to this committee why do you think that you are a fit and a proper person? In less than a minute.
Sure. Stop me if I go longer, but I'll try and be brief. I think I've worked and served on several boards, public boards, private boards, and I think I have extensive experience in corporate governance. I've been in very challenging statutory bodies that have been facing enormous difficulties. I think I've been able to demonstrate integrity under those circumstances. Commitment to the principles and the mandates, particularly of public institutions. I was on the board of the SABC during a very troubled time that I think was referred to in the previous committees. I think I've learned a lot of that. I think they've been very humbling experiences. I think there are not individuals who can contribute, who can fix these problems on their own. But I do think the importance of leadership is there, and I think I can bring experience from those that would demonstrate that I'm a fit and proper person for this job, both at the skills level but also at the values level.
Thank you. There is an ongoing discussion within government of the country on the fourth industrial revolution. Do you believe that the information regulator should be included in those discussions? And if you think so, why do you think it's important that the regulator must be added in those discussions?
Absolutely. I prefer, as I was mentioning before, to think about what is described as the fourth industrial revolution and often reduced to just really advanced technologies of artificial intelligence and machine learning and drones, et cetera, really as these global processes of digitalization and datafication. And that's really what they are. And so they've permeated, every aspect and are continuing to do so more and more, every aspect of our, existence, our in the economy and in our society and in our homes, etc. So I think the fact that this data is really the thing that drives the economy means that the information regulator needs to be there really at the start to ensure that important aspects of data privacy are ensured, and that of course in other ways in terms of access to data that's really needed to drive this economy, we have access to data, data information is provided, that there's accountability. So absolutely, I think it's absolutely imperative that the information regulator is ensuring that, in fact, very early on, by design, early on, privacy of people, the broader rights of people are actually respected. And this is important not only for those, because we need to get connected and make sure that there's equality and everybody's part of the fourth industrial revolution, but even those who are not connected to the internet, which is around half of the South African population, are still data subjects. And are, parts of information gathering, whether in state systems through biometric IDs or through, which will increasingly have so-called 4IR aspects to them with artificial intelligence, or whether it's through commercial, platformization. And they are public-private partnerships that are done for the delivery of public services, such as biometric ID. So these people are, data subjects, very often without any awareness of their rights, and also, the fundamental notion of informed consent in this environment where people may not actually be able to fulfill those consent forms if there are issues around literacy, et cetera, are all critical to the regulator establishing that.
Thank you very much. Honorable Glenis Bredenbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. If you are appointed, does your interest lie with data protection or access to information or both, and why?
Thank you very much. I think, for me, both, very much both. I started my life as a journalist, and so the freedom of expression, the promotion of access to information and freedom of expression, these are all very critical rights. But I don't think they're indivisible. I think in terms of, common understandings of human rights, is the importance of inalienable indivisibility of them. So I think they're absolutely critical. I think there are very interesting and challenging tensions between them sometimes, but I don't think they're unresolvable. So, for example, very quickly, with COVID-19, I think it's really raised the issue of individual privacy as opposed to, a collective interest and common interest in, having potentially to forego, complete privacy on certain things in order to get the kind of mass surveillance that you need to deal with a disease, to prevent the virus spreading. And I think a lot of privacy activists have seen this as, an infringement that you either have to protect people or you give it up completely and then you have the dangers of surveillance. But I think very critically, and I think it was very unfortunate in some ways, although South Africa produced a very elegant solution with the COVID-19 designated judge to deal with this issue, I think it was unfortunate that the information regulator had not already become operational, because I think a lot of the things that had to then be in the regulation would have actually been covered by the law and would have ensured that the privacy protections were there, the anonymity was there, and the oversight was there for the data collection necessary for contact tracing and that kind of thing. So, as I said, I think they're both very, very important, and I think they're very much aligned. As soon as one starts speaking about the access to data and the requirements to access certain data, and particularly under this COVID situation, you see the importance of, getting information from some of these big data providers who could contribute to containment of the disease, but in fact have done so very much on their own terms. So initially refusing requests from many governments to give this information, but then creating the technologies and the applications in order to provide the information on their terms that actually gives them greater opportunities for data collection, surveillance, and monetization.
Thank you very much. And then secondly, on the 1st of July 2020, the remaining sections of POPIA became effective. but there's a grace period of 1 year for responsible parties to become compliant. If you are appointed, you will join the regulator at a time when it must shift its focus from capacitation to implementation. How do you think you'll be able to contribute?
I mean, it's an interesting question, and if only one had the luxury of, you know, of doing one or two. I think the challenges for the regulator, and that have been articulated very often publicly and in conferences, etc., challenges of capacitation of the organization are enormous. And we are still, you know, looking for the operationalization of those parts that you know were operative, and of course that now going forward. So, you know, the codes of conduct, the mechanisms that we need to ensure that when people think the complaints mechanisms, etc., all are still things that we have to do. Obviously, they're also parts of now making that operational, but I think there's enormous challenges around capacitation, and it's that they still have to be addressed. And I think focus of things being operational, a lot of private resources, a lot of resources have been put into the compliance of companies, but I would argue that not sufficient has put into the awareness raising and the consumer kind of components or citizen components of making the law operational so that people are actually aware of their rights and able to exercise them. Nor, I should say, innovative ways of people who are not in a literate environment, you know, actually participating in that effectively.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Glenys Bredenbach. Honorable Janje. Honorable Janje. Honorable Janje.
Chair,
the time.
Thank you very much, Chair. Prof, we have 5 minutes. I just want you to make this the best of your 5 minutes. What, in your view, are the key challenges and the risks of the information regulator in its establishment? This is an emerging institution, it's not old. And I'm not looking for you to offload the whole of South Africa here. Just give me one key challenge or risk that you can table here and share with me. How would you mitigate that challenge?
My experience in institutions and also in institution building, new institutions, is that the problem is that we've often had good law and we've had good institutions established, but very often we have not been able to capacitate those institutions, and we've not ensured that they are able to act in accordance with their mandate. So I think what we have here with the establishment of the information regulator is a great opportunity to address some of the challenges that the Human Rights Council faced in delivering this. So I think it's really important to get some of these basics right around the operationalization, as I mentioned, of the organization, the records management, the systems, the codes of conduct in place. I think the risk of having, once again, quite fine legislation that we have not capacitated sufficiently, that we haven't implemented, there are a number of things that we absolutely have to do to get this operational, and the risks of failure, of institutional failure, unless we do get the resources to do that, are very, very high.
Let's narrow it. How would you mitigate? I'm more interested on the information regulator. Yeah. I know of the South African problems around these issues. Yeah. On the information regulator.
So So I think, you know, as I said, the challenges around implementation are going to be around getting the codes of conduct out and, you know, getting them finalized, identifying new areas that we have to develop codes on. I think the issue of education and awareness raising is absolutely critical if the institution is not going to risk becoming, you know, in service only of industry. And I think, as I said, in order to do this, it's going to be essential that the regulator has the resources to do this and have the capacity to implement
On that point, of resources, let's get to the next point. So let me give you the bad news. This institution does not have the resources. So this is the next point. And you might have researched that and understood. We're operating in an environment of budget constraints. COVID has worsened that. You are getting into this space where you are asked to punch above your weight and make this institution an institution that bites without resources. What innovative suggestions are you going to bring into this issue? I'm already telling you, it doesn't have the resources. Yeah. There's no assumption here.
Yeah. So I will make the point about responding to the resources, but I do think practically going forward, there's a lot of goodwill towards the you know, with a number of civil society organizations and even with certain private institutions, there is a lot of goodwill to get this organization working. I think we can partner with organizations in order to deliver in certain areas. I think certainly in the areas of awareness raising and education, there's a number of civil society organizations one could work with. In terms of the codes of conduct, et cetera, I think the forms of public participation are very valuable in, you know, bolstering the expertise that's required in order to develop, you know, not just cut and paste best practice from other environments, but what is really appropriate to ours.
Just pause there. Just on that point, you're raising the theme of partnering with other institutions, and I'm going to ask you, don't you think that partnering can affect the independence of the information regulator?
So I don't think so. I mean, I do think the independence of the regulator is absolutely critical. And I think the separation of the information regulator from the Department of Justice is an important one in law to establish that autonomy. It doesn't make it independent of the Constitution or the state or anything else. It's actually for purposes of implementation. And I think that's going to be particularly important as we demonstrate the importance of the regulator in a post-COVID environment, where it will have to be, as I said, putting groups that have felt very strongly around privacy against other groups and making decisions that must be very clearly not appear to be aligned either to industry or to the state. So I think that's absolutely critical. The partnerships, as long as they are done transparently.
That is to be continued. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Velma.
Thank you very much, Chair, and good afternoon, Professor Gilwald. And in plain language, for people, in a way that people on the ground can understand, could you please give us your view on the legislation to your, what is the purpose of the legislation to protect personal information?
Thank you. Well, I mean, I think that, you know, the purpose of the legislation is to protect the fundamental rights that people have to privacy, but also, you know, to have this legislation linked to the Promotion of Information Act is a very important and I think interesting factor. So the protection of one's privacy becomes increasingly you know, amplified in this datafied environment that I was mentioning, and increasingly valuable, in fact. So I think the purposes of the legislation is to ensure that in our increasingly digitalized environment, but also, you know, across society, in terms of elections, for example, in terms of, you know, public databases, this legislation is designed to protect the information of individuals in order to safeguard them against abuses of that legislation. That we've seen with regard to SASSA, for example, with private delivery of the grant system and the sale of data to third parties, particularly in a situation where people
Thank you, Prof. I just need to move on to my next question. Papier, again, what is its aim exactly? What is its aim?
So I think the aim of the Act is to establish, systems firstly to safeguard rights, but also to establish systems and institutions in order to do so.
Thank you. And then the special personal information. What is that, and why is that category treated differently?
Well, I think over a long period of time, even before datafication, special information such as health information, private information that could impact very negatively on one's well-being if it was disclosed to other parties or if it was used against one in some way. Is the purpose of that. So that they're over and above rights to privacy with general information, there is certain information such as health information that requires additional safeguards.
Okay, thank you very much. Do I have more time, Chair?
We have a minute left.
Thank you. Prof. Allison, I know you're very involved in work in Africa, so I'd like to understand if you can give us challenges. Your understanding of the challenges related to access to information in South Africa.
I think the Promotion of Access to Information Act at the time that it was introduced early on in our democratic development and institutional development was an extremely important one. And I feel that over the last, 25 years now, that there's actually been an unfortunate lack of, use of the legislation. I think although we've had, a number of key cases, the actual mechanism set up to access information have been very cumbersome. And so the result, you've basically got the use of the judicial review process to actually get some sort of strategic rulings, some jurisprudence around this. But I think, the emphasis that has been put on this as a strategy by civil society is that I'm not sure that the jurisprudence that we have is actually really fulfilled the intentions or the purposes of the strategic intention to get it. I think that although we've often had some disclosure of the information, we haven't always necessarily got that done through court. So there's been a sort of circumvention of that message, mechanism when it's finally come into play. And so I think, it really needs, I'm hoping that within the information regulator, those processes will be streamlined and ultimately that we will be working within a much broader open data framework that would make a lot of the data that we've been unable to get from government, available by default.
Thank you, Prof. Honorable Sarah.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Professor. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
In the background that you've given us, you work extensively with various multilateral agencies, including the International Telecommunications Union. Now, I want to touch on the aspect of Africa and internet usage, where we know, according to the International Telecommunications Union, the percentage of people on the continent using internet has increased from 1% to 24.4% in 2018. At the same time, there's an increasing concern about the disregard of personal data in this area by social media networks. And of course, we've got all the fake news, the growth of cybercrime. Now, how would you balance the protection of citizens from cybercrime and, of course, ensuring the internet freedoms? This obviously is a challenge. And what role do you think the regulator can play in maintaining this balance? I'd just like your comments in that regard. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Relationship of cybersecurity to data protection, these are not mutually exclusive areas at all. Creating a safe and secure internet is as much an issue of cybersecurity as of data protection as well. And in fact, they complement each other and need to be understood as that. It's only with the abuse of both cybersecurity or for cybercrime and data protection that you face a problem. So when there are not limitations on surveillance, for example, you are going to get exploitation, probably very often in the name of cybersecurity. You're going to get surveillance that infringes privacy and doesn't comply with global norms on data protection. So I think these are absolutely critical again to collaborating with the instruments of global governance, the forums of global governance, because these are essentially global public goods, data, cybersecurity. These are global public goods. They're now generated at the global level, and they can really only be managed at the global level. And I think big countries, strategic international affairs departments, etc., know this. The US, many countries in Europe, their international affairs departments put millions of dollars and euros a year into developing cybersecurity capacity in Africa, and now increasingly data protection, because as I said, the global system is as strong as the weakest link, and that's why we've seen a lot of cybersecurity infringements at the moment are coming out of Africa, where we don't have adequate safeguards or protections or systems, actually, response systems to respond to that. So I think the African Union, we work very closely with the African Union, and the African Union has a number of initiatives around this. But something like the Malabo Convention, although agreed to some years ago now, I think it's gone up from 5 to 12 in the last heard, but it's still a very minimal number of countries that are actually signatories to these. So, I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think they're absolutely part of, creating this governance environment that we need to collaborate on. But as I said, the important aspects of those, both the data protection side and the cybersecurity side, is that people are really made aware of the harms that go with all these fabulous things that go with the internet and Internet of Things and various things that go with that. The people are made aware of the harms, and that systems are in place to mitigate those risks, because they're extensive and they're extreme.
Thank you, Chair. How's my time? I think I'm up. Thank you so much.
Yes, there was not going to be time for responses. Thank you very much, Honorable Swart. Honorable Jolie.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good afternoon, Professor. On the same note that you have just mentioned, when we're answering Honorable Velma on the matters of protection of individual information, I just want to know, what are the main threats or risks of individuals on their personal information?
Thank you. So, I mean, I think if you think about threats to personal information, this information, you know, can be used for criminal purposes, for identity fraud. You know, there are a number of quite specific harms that can go with breaches of data privacy. But I think there's also a generalized concern about the harms attached to an environment that is increasingly, you know, operating on the basis of collecting information. That it's no longer about, you know, being aware that you're filling in a form that is then, you know, you can consent or whatever. Every day as we you know, go onto our various social networks, as we order things online, as we do our banking, we are leaving what, you know, is often referred to as these data fumes that are actually being used now increasingly for, you know, big data purposes and for essentially the manipulation of behavior. So, you know, finding mechanisms to ensure that people are only providing the information that they wish to, and obviously providing information is very important. You know, the advantages of a biometric system, ID system, or, you know, becoming visible to the state for purposes of a grant or something like that are very important. One just wants to make sure that those privacy, the threats associated with that in terms of the things that I've mentioned, would be mitigated.
Thank you. Do you believe that the commencement of certain sections of COPIA can create new economic opportunities for South Africa?
Absolutely. I think there's considerable evidence that a secure and trusted environment is actually the main, you know, one of the main drivers of e-commerce. And I think particularly in the context of COVID and economic reconstruction and the far greater dependence we're going to have on the African Continental Free Trade Agreement, getting data environments in place, getting data environments for cross-border flows is absolutely you know, a precondition for that. And you know, it's going to be one of our main levers in economic reconstruction in South Africa and across the continent.
Okay. Public awareness and education on the role of this regulation is very critical. How would you ensure that you reach all South Africans as far as in the areas of those that are not urban, since you are part-time? Can you, okay. How are you going to do that since you are part-time?
Yeah, so I think I think the part-time nature of the members really is that, you know, how much it still allows them to contribute to the programs of action that hopefully will arise from the information regulator. And I think the issues of awareness raising, particularly in rural areas, is an enormous challenge. And I speak about this from experience with the Independent Broadcasting Authority and with SATRA before it became ICASA, where, you know, we really had budgets and we were committed. We would go out into rural areas for hearings. And this is it's an enormous challenge when you're wanting to, you know, hold a hearing on Spectrum to get people to come to a town hall to engage. I think with the possibilities and the benefits now of social media, there are certain groups we can tap into. Obviously, in the rural areas, we still have an enormous challenge because of the lack of take-up of a lot of the online instruments that one could use for this, online services one could use for this. But I think it's an enormous challenge. I think it's a very exciting challenge I think the number of toolkits, very basic toolkits that have been put out in different languages, things that Media Monitoring Project, for example, have put out around fake news, trying to get people to be aware and more diligent about information. And I think these are things that we can do. And I think, again, their partnerships with entities that are geared towards this is what we need to focus on.
Okay, the last one is about local government elections next year. So lots of personal data, digital campaigns will be used. And this data must be processed lawfully. What is your view on this one?
Yeah, so I think, I think there are two aspects to that. The one, of course, goes back to the famous case of the issue around, privacy and voters' roles. And I think that's, again, like some of the issues that have arisen under COVID, I think that's a very interesting challenge on, what information should be available and what is actually a breach of privacy in terms of, creating viable political systems on the one hand, where people, need to get information in order to canvass people and the privacy of people on the other hand. And mm-hmm. at local government election, that's a particular challenge.
Thank you, Prof.
Sorry.
Thank you very much.
Answer the other part of your question. Apologies.
Honorable Mufuke.
Thank you, Chairperson. Prof, I just want to check on you now that you have answered the question that there's a threat to our personal information. How many credit bureaus are in South Africa? And how many that are international and local?
Oh, I'm afraid I have no idea.
Okay, Prof, now that you don't have an idea on that, when you saw the information about Experian, didn't it made you to say, I need to investigate on who is Experian, who is TransUnion, and all that? I can tell you now that the big, maybe to give you this information, because if you work on information regulator, I think for you being there, you need to come up with innovative things and assist them. They must know how many are they in the country. Experian cannot just come like nowhere. There are three big ones. That's the information I can give you. It's TransUnion, it's Experian, it's Equifax. And look at the background of all of them. They are American coming to UK and then come to Africa and say Africa, Swaziland and all that. That wouldn't be something that will worry you. And out of that, you have almost 8 of them, small ones, ClearScore, Credit Karma, FICO and all that. And some people don't know about them. We blame Experian, but we have a challenge of many of others that actually are taken from the big bosses. Now that we have Home Affairs, with the same information of you and I, don't you think it's high time that we need to advise on South Africa getting its own credit bureau?
As I've indicated, I have no experience other than general, popular information on the credit bureaus. Obviously, the aspects of privacy in relation to credit bureaus and credit ratings and organisations that use data of this kind, I'm familiar with, but I'm not familiar on the industry in and of itself. I think the Experian breach is something that could have happened to anybody. I think the importance of localization is very important across a number of areas. It's also important to, balance and weigh in terms of our need for, global integration, global trade, et cetera. I think the Experian breach, as you refer to it specifically, as I said, could certainly happen to any organization or to Home Affairs. And I think, the imperatives are there on government to ensure, as a attempts to do through the cybersecurity legislation, which has unfortunately also, of course, been delayed over a very long period of time, to try and mitigate that and limit that. It's extremely difficult. All one can hope for is, setting up mitigation procedures, response processes, reporting these information breaches when they're there. And there do seem to have been delays there with Experian in the time that they made known that that there had been a breach. So all of these really need to be tightened. The cybersecurity legislation needs to happen as quickly as it can. That has happened to the credit bureaus. It's absolutely shocking. but it could happen to anybody.
Honorable Mfuke? Honorable Mfuke?
Frozen, Chair, frozen.
I think already her time was up. Can we go to Honorable Horn?
Thank you, Chair. Professor, in the questionnaire to candidates, you make this statement that in respect of the annual reports public entities was to submit to the Human Rights Commission in respect of how they dealt with requests for access to information, there's very little available, and you say that the Human Rights Commission seems to have given up now. We know this function is to be transferred now to the information regulator. And you do make mention of the fact that the POPIA Act give alternative review mechanisms and stronger powers to the information regulator to enforce. But ultimately, if you are the successful candidate, apart from making use of those powers, what do you think must be done differently to ensure that there is a proper embracing by specifically public institutions of the Access to Information Act?
Thank you. I think, the establishment of the information regulator and the powers that it has really enable it to enforce the legislation in a way that the Human Rights Commission was, very frustratedly, I'm sure, for itself, very unable to do. So the fact that the law is only subject to the Constitution, and that there are powers of penalties will allow enforcement. As I said, it's going to be operationalizing those very rapidly that that we need to put in place. In terms of the mechanisms, the complaints procedures, etc., were also very cumbersome. And essentially, under the Human Rights Commission, prior to the amendments in this law for the Act Promotion of Access to Information, essentially the appeal mechanism after the adjudication process within internal adjudication process was the judicial review process, which was obviously extremely resource intensive and really only used by a very small number of civil society and private players. So effectively then the reporting mechanisms required of the public sector were finally just kind of in abeyance after initial efforts to get them and failure to get them. There appear to be no records. It's very difficult to make an assessment of the effectiveness of this legislation, because unlike other similar bodies in Australia or the UK, where you have you can say in this year there were X many number of requests for information. So many were successful. These were declined. These actually went for adjudication. These went on review. We just don't have that information. And I think that's going to be a critical matter of record for the information regulator to get in place. And then I think making, you know, the ease of getting data really needs to be done. I mean, a lot of government departments had, you know, these access to information things. I've, you know, given up using them. I've sort of assisted some people use them in order to get information, both from private or, you know, partially private entities and from government agencies. And it's, they were just very, very cumbersome. There was a lot of, you know, lack of responsiveness and delays, et cetera. So I think speeding up those processes, making them more streamlined, and then, as I said in that short memo as well, is you know, really putting this access to information in the data economy into a context of open data, so that certain of this information that really should be public becomes public by default, and it's really only the issues of, you know, what is classified information that, that becomes more difficult or becomes, you know, there more thresholds to go through.
Okay, thank you. You also referred in a previous questions of other colleagues to the risks to our privacy, and unfortunately the Honourable Maseko Jele's time was up when you start discussing the issue of what I think you called it a privacy environment characterized by the collection of data and the impact that might have on next year's local government election. So we sit with these global companies, Facebook, Google, Amazon, who really specializes in this. And of course, the big risk for us as a country is that, and I think you also referred to it, that it can be used to manipulate behavior. Do you think POPIA and our legislative framework as it stands is strong enough to address that risk? And if not, how do you see the way forward unfolding?
Well, I think this is a very good example of the need for global cooperation in order to you know, bring organizations to book. I think, you know, up until Cambridge Analytica, there was acceptance, or maybe the GDPR as well, but it's certainly, you know, across the global north, there was a kind of acceptance that self-regulation might work with these companies. And I think, you know, I think since then, I think the you know, significant fine, although it probably made very little difference to Facebook, after the Cambridge Analytica incident, demonstrated that, you know, certain information regulators with enforcement powers could do certain things. So I think here, and I know the information regulator here is very closely cooperating and linked to the information regulator in the UK, for example, and a number of them that have committed to the information regulators conference. You know, especially at the time of an election, I think we need to see what we can do in terms of global collaboration, because I don't think any act, you know, which is essentially a national jurisdiction, can really, is able to enforce these mechanisms on international players based elsewhere.
Thank you very much, Prof. We have come to the end of our interview. Is there anything that you think you should disclose if found out it can put you in a very bad light and affect the reputation of the institution?
I don't have anything that I need to declare.
You don't. And thank you very much. How were the interviews? Did you find them to be fair? Did you find the questions to be fair? Did you find the process to be fair?
Absolutely. It's been very interesting. I would love to have been able to talk more and engage more and hear the other candidates, because I'm sure that must have been very enlightening too.
No, thank you very much. We will make the decision as soon as possible. You would know that we've got a lot of workload with the three GPV bills before us, but we'll try to expedite this process, and you would know as soon as we make the decision.
Thank you very much, Honorable.
Thank you very much, Prof. Have a good day.
Thank you.
A good afternoon.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Honorable members, I'm informed that